somewhere I read, of the freedom of speech.
Et qui défendait la liberté d'expression.
The moment you limit free speech, it's not free speech.
Somebody will say, oh, freedom of speech, freedom of speech. These are foolish people.
Welcome to Clear and Present Danger, a history of free speech, by Jakob Mshangama.
Clear and Present Danger relies on the generous support of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, Fridor, and the Politiken Foundation.
Episode 29, The Philosopher King, Enlightened Despotism Part 2, Prussia. The best argument against democracy is a 5-minute conversation with the average voter. This quip is often attributed to Winston Churchill, although its authenticity rests on flimsy ground. But the sentiment that the average voter is too stupid to be entrusted with a voice in the affairs of state pops up from time to time. And in the age of social media, you need only to scroll through your Twitter and Facebook feeds to confirm this elitist bias. Though it should be said, it's not hard to find examples of politicians, of all stripes, whose views do not exactly lend support to the idea that the people's representatives are all virtuous geniuses. Which shouldn't come as a surprise. After all, politicians are elected by the very people whose social media updates give you headaches from slamming your head against your desk in despair. If both the people and their representatives are too ignorant, gullible, and deceitful to be entrusted the reins of power, wouldn't it be better to hand them over to someone whose person embodies virtue, intellect, wisdom, and justice? A philosopher king, or queen, who could ensure just the right mix of liberty, order, justice, and tradition to ensure the general welfare of all? In mid-18th century Europe, many of the finest minds around certainly thought so, when a Prussian prince emerged and dazzled all with his wit and intellect. Last episode, we charted the rise and fall of freedom of speech and Enlightenment values under Russia's Peter and Catherine the Great. In today's episode, we continue with another bona fide member of the Club of Enlightened Despots, namely Frederick II, or Frederick the Great, of Prussia. As you'll remember, things ended on a sour note with Catherine, who introduced freedom of speech to Russia, only to find out that if ungrateful intellectuals were going to abuse this new liberty to criticize rather than praise her absolute monarchy, well, then she actually preferred censorship. Especially since the French philosopher had discarded Voltaire's groveling attitude towards monarchy in favor of revolutionary ideas that might have started out with demands for representation, tolerance, and freedom of thought, but ended up with monarchs being guillotined and tradition drowned in the blood of the terror. But Frederick ruled over Prussia, a more cultured, modern, and manageable state than deeply traditionalist and unreformed Russia. So might Frederick succeed where Catherine failed in squaring the circle of absolute rule and freedom of expression? Frederick the Great ruled Prussia from 1740 to 1786. He's probably most famous for his military exploits, such as the conquest of Silesia and the Seven Years' War. The French statesman Mirabeau supposedly said that Prussia is not a country with an army, but an army with a country. But Frederick was also a philosopher. As early as 1729, he referred to himself as such. He read voraciously, became a Freemason, and would go on to write several philosophical works. And Frederick claimed that he was merely the first servant of the state. The idea of a philosopher king goes back to Plato, but Frederick's ideal was the Roman emperor Marcus Aurelius. You'll remember Aurelius praising free speech, or paresia, in his Meditations, as detailed in episode 3. But you may also remember that Aurelius did not extend paresia to obstinate Christians persecuted under his reign. Perhaps that should have been a sign of the inherent problems in mixing absolutism and enlightenment. Frederick's progressive attitude saw him praised by many of the Enlightenment's leading figures, including, of course, Europe's chief enlightener and favorite court philosopher, Voltaire. The two corresponded frequently and intimately, sounding sometimes like two giddy schoolboys. Before meeting in 1740, Voltaire wrote, "I'm sure to faint from joy." And Frederick responded, "I believe I shall die from it."
Get a room, guys.
Voltaire even spent 3 years at Frederick's court before the two huge egos fell out. But they kept corresponding nonetheless. Frederick was also embraced by the Prussian philosopher Immanuel Kant, who insisted that the Age of Enlightenment and Age of Frederick were synonymous. Frederick's new cause did not start entirely from scratch. Prussia's Calvinist Hohenzollern rulers had embraced a cautious model of tolerance so as not to alienate their mostly Lutheran subjects, and had also invited other Protestant minorities to settle within the kingdom. In 1694, the University of Halle had been founded and was home to early German Enlightenment thinkers such as the rationalist Christian Wolff. But in 1723, Wolff was hounded out of Halle after giving a lecture on the ethics of Confucianism, which was deemed subversive to theology and religion by pietists. They convinced Frederick Wilhelm I that Wolff's philosophy was deterministic and would strip the king of the right to discipline soldiers who went AWOL. Consequently, Wolff was supposedly given 48 hours to leave or face strangulation. The Berlin Academy of Sciences was established in 1700 by another German giant, Gottfried Wilhelm Leibniz. But as you can probably guess from Frederick Wilhelm's reaction to Wolff, the Academy was hardly a bastion of intellectual freedom. Compared to his pious and arch-conservative father, who used to beat, humiliate, and even came close to executing his own son, and who had a fondness for watching those who crossed him being strangulated, Frederick was indeed a breath of fresh air. Upon assuming the throne in 1740, he commenced a blitzkrieg of Enlightenment reforms. Within the first year of his rule, he lifted the censorship on the journal Die Berlinischen Nachrichten. The same year, he welcomed Christian Wolff back to the University of Halle, free to speculate without risking his neck. He also suspended the use of judicial torture and limited the use of the death penalty. As we've seen again and again, religious tolerance was a hallmark of Enlightenment thinking, and Frederick was no exception. In fact, historian Timothy Blanning has called Frederick's Prussia Europe's most tolerant state, bar none. In 1740, Frederick was asked whether Catholics should enjoy equal civil rights. "All religions are just as good as each other, as long as the people who practice them are honest, and even if Turks and heathens came and wanted to populate this country, then we would build mosques and temples for them." He reaffirmed his attitude in his political testament of 1752. "Catholics, Lutherans, Reformed, Jews and other Christian sects live in this state and live together in peace." And "if the sovereign, actuated by a mistaken zeal, declares himself for one religion or another, parties spring up, heated disputes ensue, little by little persecutions will commence, and in the end the religion persecuted will leave the fatherland, and millions of subjects will enrich our neighbors by their skill and industry." In other words, Frederick's commitment to tolerance was motivated as much by reasons of statecraft as by principle. He was not going to repeat the mistake of the Sun King, whose repeal of the Edict of Nantes saw the mass exodus of skilled French Protestants. As for Frederick's personal views on religion, he was dismissive and scornful. "It is of no concern in politics whether the ruler has a religion or whether he has none. Christianity was
an old metaphysical fiction stuffed with miracles, contradictions and absurdities, which was spawned in the fevered imaginations of the Orientals and then spread to our Europe, where some fanatics espoused it, some intriguers pretended to be convinced by it, and some imbeciles actually believed it."
Such ideas would get you locked up or even executed elsewhere in Europe. It should be said that Frederick held a rather dim view of Jews. In the political testament, where Frederick declared himself to be tolerant of all faiths, he also described the Jews as the most dangerous of all sects. And the majority of Jews, those who did not enjoy special privileges, suffered various humiliating symbolic repression and discrimination, such as a body tax normally levied on cattle. When entering a city, they had to use a special designated gate, and Jews were even liable to collective punishment. If you have followed this series, you will know that a commitment to religious tolerance is a necessary but not sufficient basis for the broader freedom of speech. So how free were the tongues and pens of Prussians? The Scotsman John Moore wrote the following account of his visit to Berlin in 1775.
Nothing surprised me more when I first came to Berlin than the freedom with which many people speak of the measures of government and the conduct of the king. I have heard political topics and others which I should have thought still more ticklish discussed here with as little ceremony as at a London coffee house. The same freedom appears in the booksellers' shops, where literary productions of all kinds are sold openly. The pamphlet lately published on the division of Poland, wherein the king is very roughly treated, is to be had without difficulty, as well as other performances which attack some of the most conspicuous characters with all the bitterness of satire.
And true enough, in letters to Voltaire, Frederick praised the advancement of Enlightenment principles which were replacing superstition and fanaticism. And even if good books were still censored in many European states, the combination of tolerance and press freedom was a killer app that would ultimately win and ensure the triumph of the truth, for which Voltaire had so long been Europe's foremost champion. Moore's account and Frederick's Enlightenment platitudes might give the impression that freedom of expression was a fundamental right protected by law in Prussia. But that was not the case. The freedom, or liberty, enjoyed by the Prussians was permissive and negative rather than fundamental and positive. It stemmed from a comparatively light-touch censorship regime, which worked to the satisfaction of most of those who participated in the small but growing public sphere of Prussia, with Berlin as its mecca. Prussia formed part of the Holy Roman Empire, but the emperor's jurisdiction was very loose, including when it came to censorship, and the many German states that formed part of the empire were subject to a patchwork of imperial, state, and local laws that were inconsistently enforced, allowing for wide differences in the climate for free speech in Germany. In the early 18th century, Hamburg was the most tolerant, if cautiously so, city in Germany. But under Frederick, Prussia grew to be a thorn in the side of many of the other, particularly the Catholic German states, who struggled to keep out banned and impious books that were published freely in Prussia. In 1747, Frederick tried to overhaul the sprawling system of censorship in which the Lutheran Consistorium was responsible for screening religious books, the Foreign Service books on foreign affairs, and specialists from the Academy of Sciences or the Civil Service screened books relating to their field of expertise, such as history, philosophy, and so on. Instead, Frederick wanted the Academy of Sciences to screen all books to be published in Prussia. This model did not work out, and a publisher who printed an attack on religion pushed his luck too far and had to spend 6 months in prison. Frederick's ministers convinced him of the need to tighten censorship. He agreed so long as it was headed by a person who did not make a fuss over every trifle. And a new edict was published in 1749 and gently updated in 1772. The edict declared that
it is not our intention by any means to prevent the serious and decent search after truth, but more especially to put a stop to that which is contrary to the principles of religion as well as to moral and social order.
All books, whether to be printed or not, had to be subjected to censorship. A four-man censorship commission was established with experts on theology, philosophy, history, and law, though the Foreign Service would still censor works touching on affairs of state. Furthermore, all scandalous and offensive books printed outside the kingdom were banned from circulation. A very nice and flexible definition, to be sure. Punishments were nothing like the ones you'd find in many other places. In 1766, a young Frenchman was tortured and executed for trumped-up charges of blasphemy, which included mocking a religious procession. In Spain and Portugal, you could formally still be burned, and in England, seditious libel or blasphemy could result in stiff prison sentences. But violating the Prussian censorship edict was only punishable with fines. The main thrust of Frederick's system of censorship was preventive, meaning pre-publication censorship, which had been abolished in England in 1695. It was also focused on publishers and printers, and therefore on preventing the spread of bad books, rather than punishing seditious writers who were not even mentioned in the edict. But Frederick did have a safety valve in the shape of the Generalfiscal, probably comparable to an attorney general, who could mop up and suppress publications and punish printers and writers when the censors had been too permissive. Books meddling in foreign policy or the affairs of the great powers were specifically vulnerable to confiscation. Some of Rousseau's works were also deemed beyond the pale, and so were the works of the German spinozist Edelmann, though Frederick did offer him asylum. Some, but not all, pornographic material was suppressed too. The outrageous materials La Maîtrise, The Art of Orgasm, and The Little Man with a Big Prick were uncensored, and so was The Art of Fucking by another writer on a French visit in Prussia. If Frederick Schobel's 19th century hagiography of Frederick is to be believed, the philosopher king was more likely to laugh at than to punish libels aimed at himself. The French philosopher, mathematician, and co-editor of the Encyclopédie, D'Alembert, twice complained to Frederick over offensive comments in newspapers. But Frederick the king twice had to remind D'Alembert the philosopher about freedom of the press. Not without a bit of friendly mockery of D'Alembert's hypocrisy, he urged forgiveness for the offending writer, since
minds not enjoying liberty of the press continue in darkness, and as the encyclopedist, whose zealous disciple I am, while they cry out against all censorship, insist that the press ought to be free, and that everyone should be at liberty to write just what they want.
But when it came to matters of state and politics, Frederick was less forgiving. As we saw with Catherine, political speech is difficult to tolerate for even enlightened absolutists. Schobel quotes another letter to D'Alembert, this time on writings relating to war efforts. Frederick stressed his respect for the liberty of the press, but held that
restrictive measures are absolutely necessary because freedom is invariably abused, so that books ought to be subjected to a not over-rigid but sufficient examination in order to suppress whatever endangers the general safety and the welfare of society.
Consequently, foreign newspapers criticizing Prussia were banned in 1778, and as early as 1751, the German playwright Gotthold Ephraim Lessing complained that Berlin newspapers were sterile on account of the strict censorship.
Here I think it's appropriate with a quick comparison, because at least from a pure legal point of view, the scope and ambition of Frederick's censorship reforms pale in comparison with those of another enlightened despot celebrated by philosophes and other Enlightenment thinkers, Joseph II, Holy Roman Emperor, and from 1780, sole ruler of the Habsburg monarchy. In 1781, Joseph relaxed the strict Austrian censorship, which resulted in the so-called Broschürenflut, or flood of pamphlets, which almost overnight created a vibrant public sphere in Vienna. Previous Habsburg rulers had allowed few writings to pass through the strict censorship, which guarded the inviolability of throne and altar jealously. But now, almost 1,800 works were published in 18 months after the thorn censorship went into effect, and the publishing business grew from a paltry 100,000 Reichstaler a year to an impressive 3 million. The British ambassador reported that freedom of debate in Vienna, where writings were discussed in coffee houses and salons, was almost as extensive as in England. One of Joseph's advisors wrote to a famous Prussian publisher,
"For a man who thinks philosophically, no period is more remarkable than that which began in 1781. Such a rapid change in the general attitude, even among the common people, who put many obscurantist members of higher classes to shame, is, so far as I know, unexampled. Freedom of the press, and still more freedom of reading, for practically speaking, there is almost no book left that is not openly for sale, contributes greatly."
Yet, like Catherine the Great, Joseph soon saw insolent writers turn against him. Whereas many others, both conservatives and the general population, were deeply opposed to his Enlightenment reforms. So like Catherine, Joseph tightened censorship at the end of his reign in the late 80s, including in 1789 a ban on the works of Voltaire, which were harmful to religion and morals. So Joseph's censorship reforms may have been more sweeping than Frederick's, but the Golden Age was short.
Still, the voice of Enlightenment writers who during the pamphlet flood supported Joseph's religious policies helped ensure the survival of the chunk of his toleration edicts, which were the most progressive of any Catholic state in Europe at the time.
One of the reasons Prussia enjoyed a vibrant climate for free and uninhibited intellectual discussions was that Frederick invited persecuted writers and thinkers to reside in his realm. I've already mentioned the Spinozist Edelman, but no one was more scandalous than Julien Offray de la Mettrie, a French physician and philosopher who combined a strict materialist and mechanical view of human nature with a strong hedonistic, some would say nihilistic, impulse, where pleasure reigned supreme. In 1746, an early work of his was banned and burned publicly in Paris, and soon he had to leg it to Leiden in the Dutch Republic. But as Spinoza had found out, Dutch liberalism had its limits too. When La Mettrie's anonymous L'Homme Machine, or Man a Machine, was published in 1747, all hell broke loose. As you can guess from the title, La Mettrie viewed humans as a soulless animal guided by the blind and uncreated laws of nature. In short, man was a machine with no higher purpose revealed by God. Life had no meaning, but man could enjoy his time on earth by pursuing pleasure and avoiding pain. Nature without thinking had created a machine that thinks. Almost immediately, bigoted winds spread the sparks of intolerance from Paris to The Hague, where the book was burned and banned. The publisher, the Dutch-born second-generation French Huguenot Elie Lussac, was summoned to a strict dressing down by the Huguenot Church in Leiden. Lussac gave up some copies and promised not to reoffend, but refused to name La Mettrie as author. But his identity was leaked, and having become an intellectual leper, La Mettrie had to flee once again. Fortunately for him, Frederick had been greatly entertained by all the furious outrage that L'Homme Machine had unleashed across Europe, uniting Catholics and Protestants in righteous indignation. And apparently, Frederick enjoyed sticking it to the Orthodox of all stripes who wanted to get their hands on La Mettrie. So in a big fat F.U. to polite opinion, he decided to make the strident atheist La Mettrie his personal court physician. Though even Frederick had his limits. He might have given La Mettrie the freedom of his realm, but he wasn't quite ready to provide the same freedom to La Mettrie's ideas, because copies of L'Homme Machine were confiscated by the General Fiscal. And when La Mettrie repaid Frederick's hospitality with his work The Anti-Seneca, which not only extolled the pleasures of opium and sex, but also attacked absolute monarchy, Frederick failed to see the fun. He personally ordered the book banned and confiscated. So sometimes Frederick's commitment to freedom of speech seems to have been motivated as much by the royal trolling of throne and altar as a commitment to Enlightenment values. Despite the occasional censorship, Frederick continued to pamper La Mettrie at court. So much so that in 1751, La Mettrie died from food poisoning while eating bad game and truffle pâté pie. Though La Mettrie's enemies preferred the version where he died from overeating, a victim of practicing his own principles of gluttonous overindulgence. But l'affaire La Mettrie also gave rise to a groundbreaking, now largely forgotten treatise on freedom of expression. La Mettrie's publisher, Elie Lussac, had promised the prickly French Calvinist in the Netherlands to behave. But in reality, he was secretly busy uploading new versions of L'Homme Machine to the Dutch dark web. But he was also incensed by the Dutch authorities' draconian response. Not because Lussac was a materialist like La Mettrie. He was in fact a pious, if liberal, Calvinist, repulsed by atheism, as he had written in the foreword to the toxic work. But he strongly believed that atheism should be countered and the truth of religion vindicated in the open by debate rather than through bigoted censorship and the burning of literature by rabid theologians. This was a radical position at a time when the denial of central Christian tenets was banned in both the Dutch Republic and England, the most liberal states of the time. Lussac developed these ideas in his essay on freedom of expression from 1749. Dutch historian Viger Willemer sees Lussac's essay as the first systematic and independent European work presenting freedom of expression as a human right within the framework of natural law. That may not be entirely fair to Spinoza, who after all defended freedom of expression on the basis that every man is by indefeasible natural right the master of his own thoughts. But to me, the real groundbreaking contribution of Lussac is that he defended the right to publish a book whose ideas he utterly loathed, not only in theory, but also in practice. He literally stuck his neck out for an intellectual opponent, and an atheist at that. Moreover, Lussac provided pious Christians, i.e. the vast majority of the people across Europe, an ultimately religious justification of tolerance of impious and anti-religious speech at a time when such tolerance was rejected out of hand by even liberals. Lussac's foreword reveals a keen understanding of the human psyche. Human beings are vain creatures who vastly underestimate their own flaws and exaggerate those of others. But
even so, there would be no great harm if men could be satisfied with their imagination and relax in the idea of fanciful superiority. But no, the rage to want to make others feel one's sway and that sweet satisfaction of seeing one's fellow crawl prevents them from missing any chance to glory in such an idea.
From this inverted view of ourselves sprung the human eagerness to command, constrain, and subjugate the thoughts of others. He also anticipated John Stuart Mill by more than a century.
I am convinced that the three angles of a triangle are equal to two right angles. As evident as this proposition is to me, if someone claimed to me to have arguments which demolish this truth, I wonder if in conscience I could say that I was fully convinced as long as I had not seen the falseness of these arguments. It follows from this that we cannot take pride in the power of persuasion of the most important truths as long as we prevent atheists, freethinkers, and others of that ilk from brandishing their pen.
In other words, just because you feel certain of being right and having truth on your side does not give you the right to silence critics. After all, couldn't atheists then claim the same right? No, according to Lussac.
One must be sincere and disguise nothing when it comes to philosophy.
Moreover, ideas could in fact never be harmful in and by themselves. And while Lussac acknowledged that absolute rulers could require total submission, this didn't include censorship. Since truth can be obtained only by leaving complete freedom of expression, rulers have no such right. Virtuous, as opposed to despotic, rulers had nothing to fear and everything to gain from freedom of expression. And guess which ruler Lussac used to exemplify this maxim? Yup, good old Freddie G. It should be said that not all of Lussac's arguments are entirely convincing, nor is his logic bulletproof. Lussac was essentially defending highbrow intellectual debate among learned people. He specifically exempted lampoons and novels, as well as publications filled with insulting or indecent expressions. No way Lussac would have included Twitter feuds as a natural right. Lussac also thought that the pens of zealous theologians, such as the ones who had had his work banned and burned, should be disciplined. But that Lussac, like Der Kornhirt, has been mostly forgotten from the history of free speech, is surely a travesty. As you can probably sense from Frederick's willingness to embrace Lemaitre and Edelman while suppressing their works, Frederick's attitude to freedom of expression was contradictory and indeed much more restrictive than the effusive praise that many contemporary writers heaped upon him. As an absolute ruler, he could hardly contemplate the public expression of ideas subverting his system of government or its underlying values. This became clear when around 1770, radical French philosopher Baron d'Holbach anonymously published two scandalous and materialist books, Système de la Nature and Essais sur les préjuges, attacking both religion and the legitimacy of monarchs as opposed to the people they ruled over. D'Holbach also argued that truth and enlightenment should be extended to the masses and not only the well-educated elite. This was too much for Frederick, who wrote a scathing indictment against this enemy of kings. Superstition and credulity, wrote Frederick, was the reason of the people, and therefore religion was needed to avoid the chaos and anarchy sure to follow if enlightenment became a bottom-up process sweeping away kings and nobles along with the religious doctrines that ensured their legitimacy. In this, Frederick could count on the aid of Voltaire, who insisted that atheism can never be productive of good. He feared that the attack on both religion as such, as opposed to superstition and fanaticism, which was fair game, and monarchy, and had ensured a civil war among philosophes, creating a mortal wound for Enlightenment principles. These radical ideas were certain to alienate monarchs and nobles who, like Frederick, were supposed to be the guarantors of a well-ordered top-down Enlightenment, since everyone knew that the people couldn't handle the truth. But now, this narrow social contract was threatened by the utopian radicalism of D'Holbach, Diderot, and their ilk. From a 21st century point of view, it seems a little ironic that Enlightenment heroes who wanted to wrestle the monopoly of truth and learning from censorious theologians themselves demanded a privileged position as arbiters of acceptable opinion and ideas. To be sure, their outlook was much broader and inclusive than the most narrow-minded theologians, but they still thought a need for guardians of public morality. Diderot privately sided with D'Holbach and chastised Frederick for his failure to properly educate the masses, for prohibiting university students from going abroad, and argued that the mild Prussian censorship reflected the population's fear of Frederick. This criticism was joined by Mirabeau, who scolded Frederick for failing to secure tolerance and freedom of the press in formal, precise, and legally binding terms. This, thought Mirabeau, was proof that enlightened despots would always be schizophrenic when it came to freedom of their subjects. Closer to home, the playwright Lessing once again twisted the knife. Free speech in Berlin was just the freedom to market as many insults about religion as one likes. But if one wrote critically of touchy political topics such as the exploitation of the people and despotism, you would soon see which country is the most slavish in Europe. Fortunately for Frederick, the Prussian learned elite was nowhere near as radical as philosophes like D'Holbach and Diderot, whose writings made them enemies of church and state in ancient regime France. And Lessing's bitterness was very much the exception among his compatriots. To be sure, after 1750, Prussia saw a mushrooming of Masonic lodges, bookshops, and reading societies that fueled discussion and the sharing of ideas. But it was nothing like the Green Dragon Tavern in Boston, where average Americans read and spread revolutionary ideas lifted from hard-hitting pamphlets and newspapers like the Boston Gazette. The Prussian public sphere put a premium on civility and calm, reasoned debate and dialogue among the elite. And the premier outlet for Prussian Enlightenment thought was the influential Berlinische Monatsschrift, or the Berlin Monthly, which, as we shall see, sparked one of the most important contributions to the wider debate about the nature of Enlightenment. Tellingly, more than half the contributors to the Berlin Monthly were state employees whose job it was to further the agenda of Frederick. And many of the debates that took place in the Berlin Monthly shows that these learned men saw no conflict between furthering Enlightenment ideals and being on the payroll of an absolute king. If the Berlin Monthly was the public face of Prussian Enlightenment, the Wednesday Club was the private one. But even though its debates were private and confidential, it was hardly a Prussian version of the Sons of Liberty. Its members included senior civil servants, the editors of Berlin Monthly, theologians and philosophers. Almost all of them served the state in some capacity. The aim of the club was enlightenment of both the members and society as such. But their agenda was not to use enlightenment principles to subvert absolutism. They wanted to ensure a more perfect union between these two values. So when in the 1780s the Wednesday Club facilitated a principled debate over freedom of speech, the majority of the members subscribed to Voltaire's, and of course Frederick's, insistence that the masses were not suited for enlightenment and reason, and consequently not for freedom of speech either. An influential lawyer and reformer summed it up.
I advocate unrestricted freedom of publication for works intended only for that part of the nation which is already enlightened, and which only they will be able to read. For the reading matter of the common people, by contrast, I believe that a highly vigilant censorship is needed.
In this understanding, freedom of speech was a practical tool needed to facilitate the debate and knowledge necessary for gradual reforms and improvements of society. It was not the great bulwark of liberty which protected the people from despotic rulers and ministers, such as English radical Whigs and their American followers thought of it. In fact, the rulers and ministers had to protect the people from ideas that were dangerous without the proper learning. Although a more cynical interpretation would be that through censorship, this elite also protected themselves and their privileged position. There were only three dissenting voices of the Wednesday Club, two of which, tellingly, were also the only members not in some form of state employment. They included the brilliant Jewish philosopher Moses Mendelssohn, who in 1783 had penned Jerusalem, a highly influential defense of universal freedom of conscience to be secured by a secular state. Mendelssohn thought that enlightenment was a good in and of itself. Applying these principles to the masses might result in short-term social disruption, but these dangers were outweighed by the long-term benefits of allowing all people to freely use their intellect and judgment. Mendelssohn could find no historical examples in which either enlightenment as such or the unrestricted freedom to express one's opinion has actually been detrimental to the general happiness. Mendelssohn also highlighted the notorious difficulties of defining the red lines of censorship. Another liberal was Prussia's premier book publisher Friedrich Nicolai, who had long been critical of censorship and claimed that truth and happiness have far more to fear from the smallest limitation than the largest increase in this freedom. Even though Mendelssohn and Nicolai defended freedom of speech as a basic human right applicable to all, they didn't envisage free speech as a weapon against absolutism. They were loyal subjects, grateful to live under their philosopher king, who, according to Mendelssohn, was one of the wisest sovereigns who ever ruled mankind. In the December 1783 issue of the Berlin Monthly, Johann Friedrich Suellner included one of the most influential footnotes in the history of political thought. It asked the question, "What is enlightenment?" This resulted in a number of essays that attempted to answer this rather important question. In December 1784, the soon-to-be world-famous philosopher Immanuel Kant published a reply with the following definition.
Enlightenment is man's emergence from his self-imposed immaturity. Immaturity is the inability to use one's understanding without guidance from another. This immaturity is self-imposed when its cause lies not in lack of understanding, but in lack of resolve and courage to use it without guidance from another. Sapere aude, dare to know, have courage to use your own understanding. That is the motto of enlightenment.
Kant's point about man's self-imposed immaturity referred chiefly to religion, but an enlightened ruler also allowed his subjects to
use reason publicly and to set before the world their thoughts concerning better formulation of his laws, even if this involves frank criticism of legislation currently in effect.
In other words, enlightenment required freedom of political as well as philosophical and religious speech. This is where you might scratch your head and say, wait a minute, Immanuel. You say dare to know, challenge man to free himself from his self-imposed immaturity, and demand free political speech. But you live under an absolute monarch who gets to decide the limits of thinking, reading, and writing. So surely you must object to Frederick's absolute rule, right? To which Kant would reply,
enlightenment requires nothing but freedom to make public use of one's reason in all matters. Now I hear the cry from all sides, do not argue. Only one ruler in the world says, argue as much as you please, but obey.
That ruler, of course, was Frederick, who, according to Kant, also allowed the type of political speech he found essential for enlightenment.
We have before us a shining example with respect to which no monarch surpasses the one whom we honor.
A rather rose-tinted and flattering view of Frederick's censorship regime. But Kant was not finished.
If it is now asked, do we presently live in an enlightened age? The answer is no, but we do live in an age of enlightenment.
And while he was willing to admit that things were not perfect, Frederick was bending the moral arc of history towards progress. In this regard, this age is the age of enlightenment, the century of Frederick. Rather fancifully, at least from a modern perspective, Kant thought by freeing the minds of their subjects, Enlightenment values would unite the interests and values of ruler and the ruled, ensuring civil liberties and dignity without political freedom. This was certainly a more expansive view of free speech than that of the civil servants in the Wednesday Club, and also a much more optimistic and rationalistic one than the bulwark of liberty theory, which took it for granted that rulers would seek to abuse their powers without the checks and balances of a free press. The only flaw was that Kant's optimism about the potential of enlightened absolutism was deeply unrealistic, as he himself was about to find out. Frederick died on August 17, 1786. This may actually have helped preserve his reputation as an enlightened ruler, because had he clung on for a few years more, he would have had to deal with the fallout from the French Revolution and very likely succumbed to the illiberal temptation that saw Catherine the Great roll back her reforms in Russia. But Frederick's nephew and successor, Frederick Wilhelm II, didn't need the pretext of revolution to roll back the most progressive parts of Frederick's Enlightenment project. Frederick Wilhelm wasn't interested in philosophy and science, but in spiritism, clairvoyance, and astrology. His rule was marked, if not by counter-enlightenment as such, then at least by a backlash, not least due to the influence of the newly appointed Minister of Culture, the former pastor Johann Christoph Wüllner, an authoritarian whom Frederick the Great had described as a scheming, swindling person. On August 9, 1788, Wüllner engineered an edict on religion with the intent of stopping skepticism and rationalism from sapping the traditional tenets of faith, which he felt undermined the social fabric of Prussian society. Prussian philosophy and debate had simply become too daring on the topic of religion. On the front page, in bold, the edict stated that Enlightenment, or Aufklärung, had gone too far. The edict imposed doctrinal censorship on the curriculum in schools and universities and introduced new monitoring procedures to make sure that clerics were living up to their articles of faith. When pamphlets and articles criticized the new measures, the king complained that press freedom, or Pressefreiheit, had degraded into press insolence, or Pressefreiheit. Wüllner followed up with a new and beefed-up censorship edict in December 1788. Where the 1749 and 72 edicts solely targeted publishers, the new edict included authors and writers. Penalties now included prison, and crucially, more religiously conservative censors gradually replaced the enlightened men of learning who had been screening books with a light touch under Frederick. According to historian Eduardo Tortarolo, the number of books which were forbidden and confiscated increased dramatically. A new royal examining commission was established to root out nonconformists in the church and schools, and the new commission targeted none other than Kant. Already in 1792, the new censorship regime rejected an essay of his on religion. The following year, he smuggled the prohibited essay into a single volume of four essays on Religion Within the Bounds of Reason Alone, which passed through philosophical rather than theological censorship. This defiance was not appreciated. In 1794, the philosopher received a warning from the king signed by Wüllner.
Our most high person has long observed with great displeasure how you misuse your philosophy to distort and disparage many of the cardinal and foundational teachings of the Holy Scriptures and of Christianity.
Kant was warned not to reoffend or incur the king's highest disfavor. That same year, the publisher Friedrich Nicolai complained to the king of a drastic decline in independent printing presses, from 181 to 61 since the censorship edict of 1788. And Nicolai himself had moved his journal to Altona under Danish rule to avoid the censorship. Even the Berlin Monthly was now printed outside Prussia in Jena. But the foremost victim of the new winds was Karl Friedrich Barth. a controversial figure who had veered from traditional Protestantism towards natural religion via Unitarianism. Consequently, he was no platform by universities across Germany, and also had a rather unorthodox naturalistic translation of the New Testament banned by imperial decree, no less. But he still managed to land a teaching position in Halle in Prussia. In 1787, Barth contributed to the proliferation of German works on free speech in the 1780s with his On Freedom of the Press and Its Limits, which was more radical than most other German works in favor of free speech at the time. According to Barth,
freedom to think and judge independently from authority, independently from the pronouncements of priests, monks, the Pope, church councils, the church, this is the most sacred, most important, most inviolable right of humankind.
In 1788, the new regime purged him from the university due to his impiety. Never one to back down, Barth wrote a satirical play, The Edict of Religion, a comedy, which mocked the new religious edict as well as leading state officials, including Wilner. Frederick the Great may have laughed off such mockery, but humor appealed as little to Wilner as skepticism, and Barth was imprisoned for insulting the king. Barth's harsh fate shines a positive light on the reign of Frederick the Great, even if he was not quite as enlightened as his most uncritical supporters would like to portray him. Perhaps Mirabeau, who, as we have seen, was far from uncritical of Frederick, gave the best summary of his rule and legacy.
Today, if one excludes a very small number of principalities subjected to imbecilic tyrants, one can discuss in Germany, at least in theory, every question relating to theology, philosophy, economics, and politics. Books for which one would have been burned before the reign of the propagator of the Enlightenment are now printed and sold publicly. Profound contempt is now the fate of anyone wishing to use force to repress or punish freedom of thought. The princes and the men of letters now restrain each other, and if that is not the best state of affairs, it is at least 1,000 times more preferable than that which lasted for centuries. There we have an immeasurable advantage which the rest of Europe, as well as Germany, has reaped from the example set by Frederick.
That is certainly a more flattering legacy than that of the other enlightened despot, Joseph II, whom I briefly mentioned. He is reported to have demanded that the epitaph on his tomb read, "Here lies Joseph, who failed in everything he undertook." But without wider political freedom and popular support, the most progressive parts of Frederick's Enlightenment project rested on shaky ground and could not withstand regime change. So it may well be that the average voter in democracies is no Kant or Voltaire, but neither is your average absolute monarch. In fact, a comparatively tolerant and enlightened ruler such as Frederick is the exception, not the rule. And Frederick's Prussia was not immune to the fatal flaw of enlightened despotism, in which an enlightened ruler is succeeded by a reactionary, hell-bent on standing athwart history and yelling, "Reverse!" So perhaps another and more reliable Churchill quote is more fitting when determining which political system provides the best climate for free speech.
Many forms of government have been tried in this world of sin and woe. No one pretends that democracy is perfect or all-wise. Indeed, it has been said that democracy is the worst form of government, except for all those other forms that have been tried from time to time.
Thank you very much for listening. Today's episode was edited by Søren Stehøj, who has just become a father to a beautiful little girl called Elfrida. So be sure to congratulate him on social media. And please share and like this episode. Crucial research was, as always, provided by Matthias Meyer.